Good evening, I'm Paul Clough. Welcome to the fourth seminar in the annual series Work in Progress in the Social Studies. Tonight our speaker is Dr. Sandro Caruana, and his paper is entitled Attitudes of Maltese University Students to the Maltese English and Italian Languages. Next week, on Wednesday, 16th March, Dr. Carmel Borge and Professor Peter Mayo of the Faculty of Education will give a paper entitled Critical Pedagogy from a Southern European Perspective. Tonight's speaker, Dr. Sandro Caruana, is lecturer in both Junior College and the Faculty of Education. His PhD is from Pavia University in Italy. He is a specialist in linguistics. So it gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Caruana.
Thanks. Okay, so first of all, thanks for coming, everybody. This is a work in progress paper, and my voice is also undergoing some sort of works in progress because I'm quite hoarse. So just in case, I'm not audible, just make a sign. Adrian, you're the furthest away, so I suppose you could make me a sign in that case. Before I actually distribute a handout and explain a little bit more in detail what this talk is going to be about, I'd just like to make a little bit of an introduction, and I'd like to explain also how I actually came about carrying out this research. Basically, it all started when I was attending a conference in Ireland on trilingualism, basically, on three languages in contact within a certain amount of countries. And on the occasion, I happened to meet somebody who is basically involved in trilingualism from the University of the Basque Country. And this person basically is coordinating a project on trilingualism in Europe. So basically, areas in which there are three languages in contact are being taken into consideration in order to examine to what extent, so to say, these languages are actually used, are spoken, and the attitudes. We will see exactly what we mean by attitudes towards these three languages in contact. Just to give you an initial idea, so if you have a look at the map of Europe with the countries of the European Union, except Malta, incidentally, which are indicated on this map, this has been downloaded, has been taken from an internet site, you'll notice highlighted in yellow the areas in which this study is actually being carried out. So besides us here in Malta, there are a couple of other areas in Spain, where, for example, the area of Barcelona, where there's basically Catalan, which is in contact with Spanish, and obviously then there are also other languages which are being taught, such as English in schools, possibly even French. The Basque Country, in the north of Spain, which is, again, Basque is an isolated language, and again, within that context, there's obviously contact with Spanish and contact with English too. Then other areas, for example, the Frisian area in the north of the Netherlands, where they've got their own Germanic language, which is Frisian itself, which is also in contact with Dutch itself, and then with German too. Belgium, again, Flemish, French, and English. And Ireland, where you've got Irish, which is basically the mother tongue of a number of people, especially on the western coast, English, of course, and then any other foreign languages which may be taught in school. So, as you can see, this is actually a project which is concentrating on various areas of Europe, and I am basically in charge, so to say, or I've carried the research here in Malta as regards attitudes towards three languages in contact. So that is the basic introduction. Now, so first and foremost, what do we actually mean by attitudes? As you know, attitudes is a term which is used and maybe misused, generally speaking, so to say that very often it's very difficult to actually define what an attitude actually is. Obviously, within everyday speech, you might speak of the attitude towards somebody or towards something, and that's fine. However, what exactly does this term mean, and how is it exactly related to languages, and also how is it measurable? These are some of the issues which we have to take into consideration. I'll start off with a brief definition from Colin Baker's important book on this matter. So attitude is a hypothetical construct used to explain the direction and persistence of human behavior. And as you can see, Baker actually graphically presents the model which you've got on your handout. So basically, there are three factors which affect directly attitude, which are cognition, affect with an A, and readiness for action. Cognition is basically in terms of what Baker defines thoughts and beliefs. So somebody might think that a language, say Maltese in Malta, is important, is necessary. Somebody might think that the language is not so important or believe that it is not so necessary. Affect is basically whether one actually likes or dislikes a language. This is very common also, for example, in the case I'm from the Department of Italian. So you get a number of people who might like Italian for some reason or another, or might not like Italian for other reasons. And then there's also the third element, which is readiness for action. As I said before, attitude is quite a vague concept, so it's quite difficult to measure. So one of the elements which are also involved in attitude is whether somebody is actually prepared to actually act according to his or her beliefs. So if, for example, where you've got a minority language, like in Ireland, no, where you've got, for example, schools which use Gaelic, how ready is somebody to send, for example, his children to a school in which bilingualism is actively encouraged, rather than sending them to a school where, for example, English or monolingualism is normally the order of the day? So readiness for action actually shows whether a person is ready to act, because it's very easy to say, I like a language or I don't like it, or I believe that the language is important rather than it isn't, but an actual fact. No? How ready are we to act on these decisions? This is also important here in Malta, when, for example, in my case, I've got two young daughters. When it actually comes, to choosing a school nowadays for children, one of the reasons why, for example, at times when you are discussing also with friends, people do not or prefer not sending children, for example, to government schools, is because a lot of emphasis is placed on maybe Maltese, or a lot of the teaching is done in Maltese rather than in English in, for example, church or in private schools. Right or wrong, obviously, that's another issue, but there are these beliefs which very often influence the action a person might take and the attitudes towards the language. Then you've got another, on the handout, you've got another couple of definitions regarding attitudes. There's a definition by Eisen of 1988, which basically builds on the model, which is graphically presented in the handout. So the actual or symbolic presence of an object elicits a generally favorable or unfavorable evaluative reaction, that is the attitude towards the object. This attitude, in turn, presupposes cognitive, effective, and cognitive responses to the object. By cognitive responses, that refers to readiness for action. Responses whose evaluative tone is consistent with the overall attitude. More simply, Crystal defines attitude as the feelings that people have about their own language or the languages of others. So this is a little bit the premise. That is the way normally attitudes are considered and portrayed within, so to say, the field. Now, if we have to specifically go through what attitudes towards languages mean, what do we actually mean here, or how can we actually define what is being said? First of all, as you can see in point two on the handout, you can have attitudes towards language itself. For example, another common belief would be that people who are quite interested in humanities generally have more positive attitudes towards languages when compared to people who might be more involved in the sciences. Again, this is a belief, it might be right, it might be wrong, but it generally presupposes, so to say, a certain state of affairs. The attitudes, then again, towards a minority or a majority language. This again, for example, would be very highly present, for example, in a country such as Italy, where, for example, you've got a national language, which is obviously Italian, and then other forms such as Italiano regionale or dialetti, and generally speaking, attitudes towards a national language may differ when compared to attitudes, for example, towards dialects. So we've got also attitudes towards language variation or dialects, attitudes to language groups, communities, or minorities, attitudes towards bilingualism, trilingualism, or multilingualism. Again, here, maybe we can stop a little bit and reflect on this point. But keep in mind that, for example, up to, 20, 30 years ago, bilingualism used to actually be portrayed as something which is not necessarily positive. On the other hand, often it used to be portrayed as something negative, something which could interfere, so to say, or cause, for example, negative transfer between one language or another. Nowadays, obviously, things have changed. Research has shown that bilingualism tends to be a positive aspect. Countries in which monolingualism is the order of the day, England, Italy, France, basically tend to encourage also the study of, for example, a new language even from the early years. So attitudes, again, have changed over the course of time in this sense. Again, attitudes to trilingualism and multilingualism, especially multilingualism in the areas which I've shown you before on the map. Attitudes, for example, to learning a new language, or, for example, the attitudes of parents to language learning. Again, in this case, when parents have a positive attitude to language learning, very often children are influenced positively towards languages themselves. This is pretty logical, but again, it's important to point these out because they are the premise of the study which has been carried out. Furthermore, on page 2 of the handout, there's a clear distinction between what are defined as instrumental and integrative attitudes. I refer there to a study by Micheli, by Silvia Micheli, which is a very interesting study, I believe, on the Maltese situation. Basically, Micheli uses this definition, which we'll come to later too. So, instrumental attitudes concern the motivation to learn a language for useful, utilitarian purposes, to find a job, to further one's career prospects, to pass exams, to read technical material, etc. Integrative attitudes, on the other hand, refer to the desire to identify with another culture or language group. To anticipate maybe a little bit Micheli's findings, when Micheli carried out an MPhil thesis here in Malta, it clearly emerged that, for example, English or attitudes towards English are highly instrumental. That is, many people see English as a language which is useful to find a job, to pass exams, to go ahead in life, to have more opportunities, especially at tertiary level. On the other hand, Maltese has a very clear integrative attitude. That is, most people see Maltese as a language which is necessary to integrate within the community, as a language which is useful very often on a day-to-day basis, but not necessarily then to go ahead in life, so to say, or to pass exams, or to reach a tertiary level of education. This distinction has come out extremely clearly in the study carried out by Micheli in 2001. Again, there are various determinants of language attitudes, which include age, gender, school and schooling, ability in the use of a language, language background, cultural background, and social class. Clearly, attitudes differ according to a person's age, very often differs also according to gender, as we will see, differ also according to the school that he or she may have attended, in the proficiency one has in languages, etc. The cultural background, even social class, affects attitude. Finally, attitude change. Obviously, attitudes are not constant over time. They are something which vary, which change over time, and which very often, so to say, are susceptible also to the various forces around them in society. So again, what changes the attitude individually or socially? We've got age changes, we've got dramatic experiences. For example, I spoke to you before about the Basque country. For example, it is obvious that, for example, Basque as a language in the last few years has been very, very encouraged and pushed in the Basque country. Why? Because obviously it is also a symbol, so to say, of independence of an area from a Spanish context, from a Spanish culture, from the situation basically, which in the Basque countries very much felt as overpowering, so to say, a certain minority group and a certain minority culture. So certain dramatic changes, even for example the presence such as in the Basque country of maybe possibly terrorist groups, might actually change the attitude of people towards the way a language is perceived, whether positively or negatively. Here in Malta, if we want to go back in time, obviously, for example, before the war, the pre-war times, a dramatic change would be, for example, seen in the language question, in all the issue which was related to World War II, which shifted, so to say, the balance from Italian to English, using, obviously, Maltese very often as a way, so to say, to lessen, so to say, or diminish the role of Italian socially. Okay? Community effects, parental effects, peer group effects, and mass media effects. Again, this is something which, as Professor Brinkhardt knows, I have very much to heart, mass media effects on language, and it's clearly seen, I mean, here in Malta in the case of Italian, wherein, up to maybe 10 years ago, the attitude towards Italian, especially because of the presence of Italian television, was definitely positive. Probably over the last few years, again, many teachers in schools also tend to confirm this, the attitude towards the language has changed. We are clearly not exposed so much. Children are not exposed regularly to Italian as they were some time ago. And again, this shift has probably caused a little bit of a change even in the attitudes towards Italian and Malta. So this is the context, the general context. As regards local research on attitudes, you see the third point on my handout. Here in Malta, quite a number of studies have been carried out regarding attitude in Malta. Obviously, I quote first and foremost research of Antoinette Camilleri on bilingualism. The reference is basically in the footnote. Micheli's study, which I have already referred to, regarding instrumental attitudes towards English and integrative attitudes, on the other hand, towards Maltese. And then a number of studies by Lydia Shriha. For example, her study on trilingualism in 2001, in which a clear negative attitude, for example, emerges towards Arabic in the study, and a much more positive attitude is seen towards Italian. Again, this is quite obvious. Also, we must keep in mind that in Shriha's study, quite a number of subjects had studied Arabic at school as an obligatory subject, and that automatically has influenced. I mean, for example, I went through this too. Adrian must have gone through this, obviously, with me. And automatically, the fact that Arabic in the, early 80s was imposed on us at school clearly created a generation in which there are many people who have a very negative attitude towards Arabic and towards the Arabic language. On the other hand, in Shriha's study, the general positive attitude towards Italian is confirmed. And this is also, I would say, confirmed by my own studies, where generally, I would say that attitude towards Italian, at least, as I said before, up to a few years ago, is generally positive. So if you turn the page, you will notice that from Shriha's studies, there are the two points which I have isolated. First of all, the fact that being trilingual is generally considered to be a very positive thing by Maltese respondents. That is, the general perception of actually knowing two languages is seen as something which is very useful and very positive. And then I have to correct a little bit the second point, the second bullet on page three, where I've got written, for Maltese living in Malta, the most important language is Maltese. That should be actually corrected. What I meant to say is that in Malta, within the Maltese context, normally, the languages which are considered to be most important for the Maltese context are Maltese, followed by English, Italian, and French. On the other hand, when respondents were asked to rank languages according to their importance, not locally, but on a worldwide scale, obviously Maltese basically fell towards the bottom of the rank, and the most important languages were considered to be English, French, and German. Please know that even here, English, French, and German are considered to be more important than, say, Italian, even locally. Okay, this is obviously related also most probably to the prestige of the languages, to the amount of, to the fact that certain languages are more widespread or not, etc. Shrihan Vassallo's linguistic survey, linguistic landscape, yield a couple of important results. First of all, the fact that Maltese is mainly used, as we said before, in familiar domains, such as work, to communicate with parents and relatives and neighbors, etc. English and other foreign languages are normally, as you can see in the second point, point C, on page 3, are mainly used to watch films, to watch television, to read newspapers, and basically for such uses. It again clearly emerges that locally Maltese tends to be more of a spoken language, and English tends to be more of a maybe written or read language to a certain extent. But keep this in mind, because as we will see a little bit more ahead, some of the results which emerge from the study which I have carried out here at university don't necessarily confirm this outlook. And then another point, which again has to a little bit be seen. For example, Maltese people in this survey of 2001, which was incidentally carried out among 500 subjects, state that they use Italian as much as they use English. Now, this is a strange result, if you ask me, because it's obvious that, I mean, here in Malta, English is more used than Italian. Again, the authors probably interpret the fact that this is because of the fact that many people are exposed to Italian via television. Okay, but basically, from the study, when subjects were actually asked, do you use Italian more often than English or vice versa, the result was actually that English and Italian were used just as much, which is a little bit of a questionable result, which probably has to be interpreted in the light of basically viewing television. It's certainly, obviously, a passive, so to say, use of Italian. Finally, another study carried out by Lydia Shriha, 2004, regarding mobile telephony. Again, a series of results over here, but what maybe is most clear-cut is that generally Maltese is used for voice calls
But then obviously SMSs are mainly in English, are mainly in English. Even here, the study has yielded quite a number of interesting results. For example, if I'm not mistaken, about 25% of the people interviewed said that if you phone up somebody on the mobile phone, no, and you actually speak to this person in Maltese, and this person actually answers you in English, they just wouldn't continue the conversation. They would either, you know, cut or stop or whatever. But in any case. Now let's go specifically to the study I carried out. So this is, as I said, the background. Now, first and foremost, this study was carried out amongst 189 university first-year students. All 189 subjects, all 189 students were, and are actually, first-year students during this academic year, and are either B.Ed. or B.A. students. That is basically courses which, so to say, are educationally related. That is quite a large percentage of the subjects which have been interviewed will eventually actually become teachers. Obviously, not all of them, because, I mean, even regarding the students who have B.Ed., it does not necessarily mean that they will complete the course. But basically, the focus was to have subjects in educationally related areas. That is basically areas which could either lead directly to a degree in education or which could eventually lead to a postgraduate certificate in education and what's not. Basically, 141 subjects were females, and there's a mistake again in the handout, 48 subjects were males, that's 25%. Again, the figures basically reflect the fact that in B.Ed., B.A., most subjects are actually female. The data collection, as you can see, was carried out in October and November, and basically, I can now start illustrating the results. First and foremost, the first pie chart that you've got on page 3, gives you an idea of the student's first language. And you will notice that the overwhelming majority of students claim to have Maltese as a mother tongue. That is, most students who take educationally related courses, 83% of them, claim to have Maltese as a mother tongue. Now, this figure is quite in line with the national average, in actual fact. I mean, most studies on language learning and on languages basically quote a figure which nowadays is around between 85% and 90% of subjects who actually claim to have Maltese as a first language. Then 4.5% have English as a first language, that is only eight subjects out of the 189 actually claim to have English as a first language. Incidentally, all eight of them were female. Okay? 12% claim to have both English and Maltese as a first language, and then one subject, which is about 0.5%, claim to have Italian as a first language. Now, a second question which I asked the students, which was part of the questionnaire, incidentally, the questionnaire which was actually used for the study is obviously a questionnaire which was originally set out by the University of Basque Country and which is actually being used in all the countries which I indicated before. So, obviously, I would have wished to investigate a little bit better certain issues, but obviously, being a study which is actually going to be, so to say, used for comparative purposes, even in other contexts, I had to stick a little bit with a general model. So, basically, university students were actually here asked to rate their own competence in the three languages, in Maltese, English, and Italian. In figure 2 on page 4, you actually can see the way the subjects actually rated their own competence. Now, this was not done simply by asking somebody, for example, how do you rate your competence in Maltese? Okay, and then maybe he might have had to tick good, very good, whatever. But people were actually asked, students were actually asked to rate their competence in each and every ability. That is basically the competence in reading, in writing, in listening, and in speaking for each of the languages. And then basically an average was drawn. What you are seeing there is actually the average. Again, this is obviously a self-evaluation, and obviously, statistically, self-evaluations must be taken with a pinch of salt, because they obviously tend to be overinflated, okay, even as figures are concerned. But in any case, these are the results which emerge. For example, you will notice that 81% of the subjects rate their competence in Maltese to be very good, 17% rate it to be good, etc. English is significantly lower, at 43% of the subjects rating their competence as very good, and 54% rating their competence as good, and Italian goes even lower than that, with 30% of the subjects rating their competence is very good, and 35.5% stating that their competence in Italian was good. So figures basically tend to be quite representative, let us say, of the situation. Then, if you have to go to table one, here maybe these are the results which we can comment on most, besides then some other results regarding statistically significant relations. So, one of the questions that was actually asked in the questionnaire was which of the languages are used when talking to the following people. Now, I rank these in order according to the use of Maltese. And again, you will notice that basically Maltese is very highly prominent when speaking to parents, to father in particular, mother, and when speaking to neighbors, and also when speaking to brothers and sisters. But notice that then, after the first four categories, there's a significant drop in the percentage. No? In fact, you'll notice that if 75% of the subjects claim that they always use Maltese to speak to brothers and sisters, no, this percentage drops to 49%, 50%, when they're actually speaking to friends outside school, friends in the classroom, and even lower when they are speaking to teachers. If then we had to take the means of communication and the language used, again, you will notice that our context is quite highly multilingual in this case. Why? Because quite a few people use Maltese, especially when listening to the radio. That's 21% or 23% who would listen to the radio in Maltese more often than in English. Then you will notice that the figures drop significantly when we've got the press, when we've got watching television, where again, watching television, you might note that for the column in other languages, that is not in Maltese or in English, there are still 42% of university students, of potential teachers, who claim to watch television regularly, not in Maltese or in English. Again, keep in mind that we are speaking about 16, 17-year-olds. So probably people, students, who were maybe more influenced by the presence of Italian television than, for example, primary students who are presently in our schools or students who are presently in our secondary schools. And again, listening to music, the popularity of Maltese music tends to be rather poor when compared to music, obviously, in English, where you've got much higher figures. Now, it might interest you to compare these figures to the figures, for example, of another context, which is the context of the Basque Country. So we can maybe do so. I wouldn't know if at this point in time there are some observations. If you wish maybe to make some observations as we go along, believe me, it's absolutely not a problem. Adrian.
I have a question about speaking always in Maltese. I mean, when somebody is asked whether he or she speaks to their father in Maltese, always in Maltese or not, I mean, that's a rather easy question. I mean, the variables are very few.
Yes.
But if you ask a person whether they speak to their friends, I mean, they might have what? 25, 30 people who they regularly meet. So there would be certainly a certain percentage who would speak in Italian or in English.
Maybe.
So I'm not sure whether that statistic or whether that first column.
Mm-hmm. How representative it is.
Yeah, I mean, whether it's in any way indicative to compare the language in which you speak to your father and the language in which you may speak to, 50 different people.
Well, yes, obviously, there is that variable, definitely, right? I mean, I agree with you on that point. I mean, obviously, as I'm telling you, the way the variables were subdivided were basically, as you can see in the various columns, always in Maltese more often than in English, in Maltese and English about equally, no? So you will notice that basically what in the questionnaire, I mean, as I said, this is basically a study which is quantitative in nature, as such, as you will see. As usual, quantitative, I like quantitative analysis, I mean, very much. Obviously, the problem with quantitative analysis is very simple, that ultimately it presents figures in a very, very neat way. But then it's sometimes a little bit more difficult to actually understand, you know, what there actually is underlying those figures or how representative they are. And that is the use also of statistical significance. Now, the data I've presented till now is purely descriptive. when I'm going to present the relations between attitude, for example, and gender, you notice that then, obviously, statistical significance comes into it and the use of chi-squared. Now, in this case, this is obviously descriptive and has to be taken for what it is, certainly. But in this case, what I meant is that the subjects were just asked to tick. Okay, so the questionnaire basically presented the subjects. I can also show you basically how this was carried out, even to give you a more clear idea of the way. So basically, this was the questionnaire, you know? And so you'd get father, mother, brothers and sisters and all that. And all the subject was asked to do was to tick the box. Okay? So basically, yes, definitely, there is a difference, so to say, in the variable, because speaking to the father, who is one person, whereas speaking to brothers and sisters might be two or three, and speaking, obviously, to friends outside school becomes much more than that. But the fact remains that the options were there. Okay. And it also reflects a little bit in the figures there. Yes.
Been applied by Shriha as well, and yes. Even the Doxa in Italy asks these differences on whether you speak dialect or language to father, mother, grandfathers, friends, and so on. What would perhaps be hidden here is the fact that usually mothers speak to children much more in English than in Maltese, or much more likely, it is much more likely for the mother to speak English to the children than the father. So that would be reflected here as well, although it's hidden.
Possibly. I mean, there's a difference of what, 6% between, you know, which is again a relatively small percentage. Certainly, there are gender differences, and you will notice this further ahead, did you feel? I mean, when we come to actually seeing the relations. Definitely, I mean, the percentage between, you know, fathers and mothers in this case is minimal. I mean, 6% is not a huge amount, but at least from what emerges in the data, it seems that Maltese tends to be used more with the father than with the mother. That I would confirm.
Another point which is against the main current, I mean, as regards viewership, is watching TV, because here they state that they follow television in Maltese very little compared to the national standard.
Yes.
I think that must be perhaps the fact that, due to the fact that these are educated, being university students.
Yes. The thing is that regarding watching TV, it's a bit of a complex issue, even because of the fact that, obviously, there are three columns. I mean, I don't really think, I mean, as you are saying, obviously, according to the statistics of the Broadcasting Authority,
that's right,
the share of most channels
over 80%
is on,
in Maltese.
Is on Maltese. But then again, local channels also transmit quite a few programs in English. So if maybe a person tends to watch TVM, that doesn't necessarily mean that the person... So basically you would have a combination maybe of the first three columns, you know, always in Maltese more often than in English, in Maltese and English about equally, which would tally, so to say, well, to around 33%, I would say. We're still below the national average, as you are saying, definitely. I mean,
for example,
the fact that 42% still indicated that they watch television in languages other than Maltese and in English is high, because the share of Italian television nowadays
is about 20%.
If not less. It's between 15% and 20%.
It's around 20%.
Exactly. Of course, but the share of Italian television nowadays is exactly around.
But at prime time, man.
But it's stable.
It's not a bit. It's quite.
What is interesting?
That means that there are, on an average, about 40,000 people watching Italian television every day.
What is also interesting,
which is not bad,
is that it's quite stable. It has now, over the past few years, it has stabilized. There were years in which it dropped consistently, and from the 40% of what, maybe the early 90s, it has dropped. But over the past few.
Up to 8 years ago, it was still 50-51%.
But the drop, it has gone down, but it seems to have plateaued a little bit now.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't gone below 15%, generally speaking.
No, it's about 20, I'm sure about that.
So
the last figure is about 2004, are about 20.
Now, if we had to compare just very briefly these figures with findings regarding the Basque Country, well, you will notice that, now, of course, it's very difficult to compare Malta to the Basque Country. The political situation is completely different, but this is the context in which I can actually present some results.
if I can maybe. Well, you will notice that, first and foremost, in the Basque country, Basque is spoken very much with teachers. Now, this is the result of the fact that in the Basque country, as I said before, there have been certain dramatic changes, and there has been a drive to use Basque in schools. So, whereas in our context, as per my handout, no, teachers figure practically in the last place, no, with 31%, okay, as you will notice, figures relating to father or mother are much lower than they are for Maltese. Here we're in the range of 85%. But it is also significant to note that within schools, because of a conscious drive and because of language politics or linguistics politics, call them what you like, there is definitely a much more widespread use of Basque when compared also to the local situation. Whereas if we go further down, definitely Maltese with brothers and sisters, mother, father, friends, is much more widespread, let's put it that way. Okay? As far as the means of communication and language use are concerned, again, you'll notice that, for example, as regards watching television is concerned, always in Basque is a very, very small percentage. There is, incidentally, just for you to know, there's one channel which transmits constantly in Basque. Otherwise, obviously, they're exposed mainly to channels which transmit in Spanish. But again, in this case, you'll notice that 53.6% of subjects in the Basque country studying to become teachers in the Basque country do tend to watch also, for example, television in Basque and in Spanish. And this percentage, if you had to tally the amount of subjects who actually watch television in the minority language, is actually higher than the amount of people who watch television regularly in Maltese, according to the results obtained. Okay, now, this may be just one other thing which I would like to specify before we go ahead. It's important to keep in mind that within the context which I have illustrated before, such as in the Basque country, in Catalonia, etc., very often languages are referred to as minority or majority languages. Basically, Basque is considered to be a minority language, such as Catalan or Friesian or whatever, because obviously they are surrounded or they are in a context in which there's another majority language which is basically spoken over and above that language. In our situation, it's very difficult to actually define. I mean, is Maltese a minority language? Not really, at least locally. It would be a minority language, obviously, when compared to English on an international scale. But again, comparisons have to be done with care, because what is a minority language in a specific context, locally, does not necessarily, have the same sort of implications, because Maltese in Malta is not a minority language within the local context. Now, if we had to return to results, I can continue illustrating on the overhead some other results which I did not present in the handouts, because basically they are also results which pertain to the statistical analysis. It's work in progress, which again has to be a little bit refined. Now, as far as Maltese is concerned, it's interesting to view the following. Let me try and focus this a little bit more. Okay, now, again, student subjects, the university students who I interviewed studying to be teachers, were actually asked to rate the importance attached to Maltese, to the Maltese language, to do the following activities. Now, what is surprising, according to me, is the fact that the activity in which Maltese was rated to be as most important was actually to write. Now, normally, as said before, Maltese is considered to be more an oral, so to say, medium. No, it's much more used in spoken language more than in written language. Yet, for some reason, which I can try to explain, but maybe which you could help me to explain as well, subjects who are studying here at university also attach great importance to Maltese when it comes to writing. Now, this could be due to, I would say, a couple of reasons. First of all, amongst the subjects, there were also some students who were specializing in Maltese. Not many, but probably these also give great importance to the fact that they are studying Maltese at university, they are going to become teachers of Maltese, so automatically this would imply that Maltese is important for writing. Also, there were a number of students within the Faculty of Education who are specializing in primary education. And then again, I would reasonably believe that for them it is important to learn what is to write and not only to speak. There might be other reasons. Maybe you could also think of others and tell me about them if you do. But I think that is the best way to imagine this situation. Of course, let me repeat, the subjects are studying to become teachers. Therefore, it's not the man in the street, if you know what I mean. So probably this also conditions the result. On the other hand, if we go down the scale, we'll notice that Maltese is important to read, to live in Malta, to make friends, to bring up children. And then we start going down the scale. To get a job, to talk to people out of university, to pass exams, it's 47%, okay, to pass exams. To make phone calls, to be accepted in the community, to go shopping, to talk to friends at university, there's a significant drop there, 36%. To be liked, to watch television, again, this confirms the statistic we've seen before. And then to talk to teachers at university, that's also at 26%, which is pretty low, but again, that's not surprising considering the fact that a number of lectures are actually held in English here, even within the Faculty of Education. Now, if we have to come to attitudes, a series of tests were carried out in which basically the subjects had to answer a number of questions which were related to attitudes. And basically, a series of questions were answered, about 30 questions in all, and from this an average is drawn. Again, this is a standardized test which is used to measure attitudes. It has been used basically repeatedly in various contexts. And within our context, if we have to summarize in the most simple way the result, you will notice that, generally speaking, attitudes towards Maltese tend to be more favorable than they would be for English and than they would be for Italian. That is basically 68% of the subjects interviewed have a favorable attitude towards Maltese, and this is higher than the 45% for English and the 23% for Italian. So that is the first result of this study, so to say. Again, we are here at a descriptive level, so we are basically just speaking of numbers. Now, if we had to actually analyze this data, and if we had to actually check whether there are differences between, for example, males and females, between, for example, the age of subjects, let's see whether these statistical differences emerge. Now, let me start off the first aspect regarding these differences. Now, the following is the relationship between variables. So, you'll notice that generally speaking, male subjects have a more favorable attitude towards Maltese than female subjects. In fact, 83% of male subjects have a favorable attitude towards Maltese when compared to the 63% of female subjects. This difference is statistically significant. The probability level is below 0.05. This means that the result did not occur by chance. That within the context, basically, taken into consideration, males have a more favorable attitude towards Maltese than females. So that is the first statistically significant result. Now, before I go on, I'd like to make again another small bracket. It's important to highlight the fact. I didn't represent this graphically, but it's important to address it. That generally, the attitudes we are speaking about are related to proficiency. There's a very high correlation between proficiency and attitudes. That is, people who rate themselves highly proficient in a language generally have a positive attitude towards it. And this again came out extremely clearly in the study. What maybe is interesting is that people who rate themselves highly proficient in Maltese generally have a very positive attitude towards Maltese, but also towards Italian. On the other hand, students, the subjects who rated themselves very highly proficient in English have mainly a very positive attitude just towards English and much less towards Maltese and Italian. Now, this is the picture, I mean, which seems to have emerged quite clearly. I don't know why Olvin is laughing, but it's obvious. But
it must be integrative.
Sorry?
It must be integrative.
Yes, but then again, I mean, there's a very clear-cut distinction. As I said,
there were very few subjects who actually stated that they had English as a mother tongue. But then again, subjects who rate themselves as being very proficient in English generally show positive attitudes only towards English, much less towards Maltese, and even less towards Italian. There are clear correlations. I still have to figure these out a little bit better. That's why I didn't present them graphically, because I don't want to be misquoted. As I said, this is work in progress. But the picture is that. And I think it emerges quite clearly in this context. Furthermore, may I add, what I'm showing you here, in the last part of my talk, because it's already 7 o'clock, are the statistically significant relations. There are many other relations, then, which are not statistically significant. For example, there were no differences in attitudes between the three languages when, for example, age was taken into consideration. Now, this is pretty obvious. Why? Because, obviously, most first-year students are either 18 years old, 17 years old. There's just a few months difference. So there, obviously, no statistically significant differences emerged. For example, there was no statistically significant difference, and this might be a little bit more surprising, between school attended and attitudes towards languages. That is, students who attended private schools or church schools did not necessarily state that they have a better attitude towards English rather than Maltese. There, basically, no, again, statistically significant differences emerged. No statistically significant differences emerged, for example, regarding the area where people live. Areas were classified in four: north, center, south, and Gozo. I had to put Gozo basically as an area on its own because of maybe it doesn't really make 100% sense, but in any case, even there, again, people from the north did not necessarily claim to have more favorable attitudes towards Maltese than people, for example, in the south, or vice versa. I get on.
Would you think there could be any correlation between the level of their linguistic intelligence and their attitude towards a particular language?
What do you mean by linguistic intelligence?
As you know, the students in our secondary schools always take Italian. They are afraid to take other languages.
In the area secondary
school? Yes. Uh-huh. However, those who go to junior lyceum, therefore academically intelligent, somewhat more...
Yes.
I'm afraid to use the word, but more intelligent.
More inclined.
They do not take Italian. One would say that there is a correlation between the level of intelligence to the language chosen. Now, could you say that it's always also applies to the attitudes? Say, for example, people who prefer Italian are less than those who prefer English.
This, obviously, I couldn't confirm in my case, in my study, because basically all students were attending first year university. So basically, that was not a variable, that was a constant, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So basically, you couldn't really rate, so to say, the groups of students as being more intelligent or less intelligent or more inclined. Not intelligent, but again, or more inclined. What I can tell you is the following, is that definitely that was not a variable which I could include in my study, because to do something of the sort, you'd have to, as you said, for example, take students in junior lyceums, as you do in area secondaries, where there's a variation, whereas in the case of my subjects, there wasn't. But what I may add is the following. Again, one of the other areas where no significant relationships emerged was, for example, where the students studied sciences or arts at sixth form. Again, where the students studied sciences or arts in sixth form did not influence their attitude towards the language. Did not, no. But then again, obviously, we are speaking about university students. So basically, students of, call it, an elite group, if you like. Okay? So, again, I mean, if I actually had to take, students who, so to say, are coming from a science background, which is normally considered to be, maybe erroneously, as a little bit more demanding, when compared to students coming from an arts background, then again, differences did not emerge. But again, I can't give you an answer to your question, because I don't think the subjects which I had underhand could actually explain this, as you know. But what I could also add is that last year a thesis was done on this topic, and for example, what we are sure of is the fact that students in junior lyceums who study Italian are also the students who obtain the lower grades in the 11 plus examination. That, yes. But this is a different issue.
However, there's another aspect, which must be taken into account, the fact that students do not study Italian at the new lyceums, or the junior lyceums, whatever they called. No, in the lower forms. Does not mean that they do not sit for O-levels.
As well.
In fact, most of them do, because they rush it, obviously, because you know, they're so clever that they know that by studying French, which is harder, or German at school, they will still have another subject in Italian, because they will do 1 year private lessons, and they pass, and they get their certificate.
Oh, there is that.
So most of those people, I think, would still have a positive attitude to Italian, because they would have already had it.
Again, most of those people would be those who probably are exposed to the language, for example, at an early age. Okay, let me just finish off with the data. So here, okay, now, as I illustrated before, there are very clear and significant differences between attitudes towards Maltese and English and the mother tongue, for example, of the subjects. So, for example, if a subject has Maltese as a mother tongue, the attitude is generally towards Maltese, the attitude towards Maltese is generally very highly positive. On the other hand, students, for example, have English as a mother tongue. Alright? Okay, here we have a small group and this must be taken into account, basically 8 students here. But you'll notice that 12.5%, that is basically 3 of these 8 students, actually have a favorable attitude towards Maltese. On the other hand, out of the 12% of the subjects who had both English and Maltese as a mother tongue, there's 48% of subjects who have a positive attitude towards Maltese. Now notice here, for example, the attitudes towards English. Students who have Maltese as a mother tongue, 38% of these students, basically, claim to have a favorable attitude towards English, and that's pretty low. Whereas, English mother tongue, all eight students who have English as a mother tongue, then have a highly positive attitude, a favorable attitude towards English. Okay, this is quite, especially this is a significant statistical data. Okay, with both mother tongue, then 74% and 26%. So, there's a clear relationship between mother tongue and attitude towards the language, in this case. Furthermore, another interesting aspect, again, statistically significant, is socioeconomic status. You will notice, for example, that subjects coming from a lower socioeconomic class, let's call it that way, that is subjects whose parents generally come from a lower socioeconomic group, have a more favorable attitude towards Maltese than those subjects whose parents come from a high socioeconomic group. And this is quite, again, significant. On the other hand, notice that for English the situation is inverted. High socioeconomic group implies favorable attitude to English. Low socioeconomic group implies a lesser number of subjects who have a favorable attitude towards English. So this is another element. Socioeconomic class, again, despite changes, despite situation which has evolved over time, has actually resulted in being statistically significant. Then, the community in which one lives, is also statistically significant. Subjects were asked whether they live in a Maltese-speaking community or in a more English-speaking community. Again, you will notice that subjects who come from a Maltese community, from a Maltese-speaking community, have generally a positive attitude towards Maltese and a less positive attitude towards English. On the other hand, subjects who come from an English community, an English-speaking community, have a higher and more favorable attitude towards English rather than to Maltese. So again, north, center, south, those did not affect the results. But whether one is actually more immersed in a Maltese-speaking community or an English-speaking community also affects attitudes in this case. Finally, the last two figures are directly concerned with Italian. Now, again,
the attitude towards Italian by the frequency of watching Italian television is statistically significant. This is something that, well, has been, I think, proved by and large at this point in time. But you will notice that, for example, subjects who never watch Italian television generally have an unfavorable attitude towards the language. So 62.5% of subjects who never watch Italian television would say, I don't like Italian, I don't think it's important, I believe that Italian is useless. On the other hand, things switch over when, for example, we consider subjects who watch Italian television 3 to 5 times a week or daily. Why? Because 35.5% of subjects who watch Italian television daily have a favorable attitude towards the language. So people who are regularly exposed to Italian via television would generally tell you, I like Italian, it's important, it's a subject which I would study, etc., etc. And finally, another significant relationship emerged, for example, between subjects who visited or never visited Italy. You'll notice that, again, statistically significant differences emerge between subjects who visited Italy, 26% of them have a favorable attitude towards the language, and subjects who never visited Italy, 15% of them express a favorable attitude. So basically, this percentage is much higher. And on the other hand, a favorable attitude would be much higher amongst those who never visited the country. So, generally speaking, if we had to put everything into perspective, if we had to take Maltese and English, there are a number of factors which involve Maltese and English which affect attitudes. These include, as we saw, gender, they also include socioeconomic class in certain cases, they also include the community in which one is basically brought up. Italian, on the other hand, tends to be very neutral. What affects attitudes towards Italian is certainly, first and foremost, still today, television, and the fact whether a person has actually visited the country or not. That is the picture which comes out. Of course, as I said already, these results are still, so to say, well, I mean, they are definite results, because the statistical analysis is what it is. But there are other issues which I think need to be also taken into consideration. Generally speaking, however, as in practically all the countries in which the study is being carried out, even here in Malta, there's a generally very positive attitude to the fact that we are trilingual or multilingual. There's also generally a very positive attitude towards Maltese, also towards English, as I said, mainly, all right, from English, maybe language speakers, but again, there's a generally positive attitude to Maltese, and generally, a very positive attitude still to Italian. And this is particularly significant, the fact that Italian generally is perceived in a very positive way. Very often it is perceived in a much more positive way than a third language, for example, is perceived in other countries and in other contexts. So, I would say that locally we are definitely in the situation, so to say, in which other countries are all over Europe, with a very positive attitude towards learning languages, and the use of language is also perceived as very important. What I would highlight is the fact that, as I said before, it is more difficult here to classify Maltese as a minority language when compared to other contexts, and the generally positive attitude also towards the third language, which is very often seen, not only, so to say, as instrumental, very often English in the Basque Country, English in Holland, is seen as something which is necessary to get a job, to pursue a career. Italian, on the other hand, here in Malta, has other uses, which are very often related to integrative aspects, such as, for example, watching television, or being able to speak about certain issues like sports, like TV personalities with friends and with family and with people who you tend to hang around with. These, I think, are important differences which render our situation, despite, as I said, generally in line with the European situation, a little bit more distinct. Okay? So that I think is basically it. But if you have any comments or questions, I would appreciate them definitely on the results and on the data. And thanks for your attention, I would say.
A couple of questions about the overall project.
Yes.
I was quite intrigued by the choice of the nations. I would have expected more of the frontier, very actively bi or trilingual areas like Valle d'Aosta, Alsace, Gibraltar, where attitudes tend to be very, very heated. Mm-hmm. And the people are extremely anxious about attitudes as such. Secondly, about the subjects chosen? Is there homogeneity in these? Are they all university students, for example, taking arts? Mm-hmm. Or are the other persons involved taking into account different areas? Because these would make the results much less comparable between them.
Yes, no. For starting from the second question, no. The obviously, the study is homogeneous. That is, in all contexts being considered, the subjects are the same. So it's basically approximately 200.
20-year-olds.
Yes. Well, first year university students taking pedagogically related courses.
I got
200 students in all the contexts. Mm-hmm. And even the data collection, for example, was done at the same period of time. That is October and November of last year. And basically, well, the results should be published in a forthcoming publication. So basically, no, the not only the subjects, I would say, even the instrument use, for example. As I said before, my hands were very much tied to actually stick to a particular model, as you said, for comparative reasons. Mm-hmm. So definitely. But there are issues which I personally would like to maybe investigate a little bit better, but maybe later. Exactly. As regards the countries chosen, yes, definitely. You're obviously 100% right. There are various areas which were not considered where definitely, I mean, I don't know, Trentino Alto Adige, Val d'Aosta, in Italy, but various other areas where the issue of trilingualism is very important. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this obviously, the choice of areas depended basically on the people who are actually coordinating the study, which, as I said before, is the University of the Basque Country. However, what I must add is also the fact that this is actually considered to be an initial project, a first step, so to say. Mm-hmm. And it was also, as I said, the result of a number of people who met in a conference in Ireland 2 years ago. And that's from where it actually originated, the idea actually originated. I believe, however, that the intention is to expand a little bit also onto other fields and into other countries. But at least as an initial project, it's centered mainly around the Spanish context and around the context which I actually illustrated. Mm-hmm. However, the person who's in charge of this, who is David Lasagabaster, who also wrote a book on attitudes in any case, or publication on attitudes, actually seems to be interested as well in expanding the whole thing also to a wider context. But when and how and whether this actually will be done, I really
Cyprus
can't.
Would be interesting as well.
Sorry?
Cyprus would be interesting.
Exactly.
As well.
No, there are many contexts where this can be extended to. Definitely. Exactly. There are various areas in Europe where this, then again, it's difficult to do everything, obviously, right. I would say.
I'm not very much into these kinds of statistical analysis, so this might be a stupid question, but I'll make it anyway. Do you think that the structure of the questionnaire tends to pit languages against each other?
Tends to pit languages against each other.
To give the person who is to give the interviewee to make the interviewee choose between one language
rather than the other, or even to choose
a language against the other. You know what I mean? To kind of oppose languages rather than
complement.
So in a way, the questionnaire somehow reflects a kind of confrontational ideology on the part of whoever somehow designed it. It's just a question.
This obviously is an issue which, yes, you might be right in, but again, I mean, it depends very often on the questionnaire which is designed and how the questionnaire is designed. Mm. In quantitative analysis, that is the first step. It's essential. If the questionnaire is flawed, if it's biased, it's obviously doomed to, take the results in a certain direction. Now, what is normally done in quantitative analysis is done precisely also to avoid that this actually happens. And there is now a very large tradition in quantitative analysis. Now, obviously, the questionnaire was originally piloted. So obviously, even I myself actually carried out a pilot study here in Malta, wherein, for example, the questionnaire was also given, for example, to two small groups of students over a different amount of time, also to see the coherence between the results given and not. The final result which was produced is obviously in line with the principles of quantitative analysis. Obviously, this does not mean that it's perfect or it's flawed. As I said before, quantitative analysis has the problem of presenting things neatly in little graphs, as I've showed you here, but then obviously it's all up to the researcher to interpret what is being done. However, what I must add is the following. As regards what you are saying, that is pitting, so to say, one language between the other, that hopefully should be avoided for the simple reason that, again, the whole idea of statistical significance, the whole issue, if you feel, of using statistical significance is to make sure and illustrate differences which are actually different when the difference between one variable and another are actually high enough to be able to actually comment. In fact, you will notice that, for example, one of the issues between, for example, schools, at a descriptive level, there was a difference. Students who attended public schools did actually prefer Maltese, but only at a descriptive level. The percentage between the two variables was too small to be able to actually say that that percentage was not the result of chance. So that is why, you know, there are these tests, such as, well, non-parametric tests like chi-squared, maybe, basically quantitative tests, which actually only enable the researcher to highlight differences when there are actually, you know, clear-cut, so to say, differences between one variable and the other. So the model should be as airtight as possible. Then again, obviously, you will, if I show you this questionnaire, probably you would also find problems, maybe, one thing, but within reason, the results are representative.
Yeah, and my other little question was, whether the kind of the formal context of a questionnaire would kind of encourage the interviewee to be a bit more patriotic, that the interviewee would feel the need to be more patriotic because he or she is answering a formal questionnaire. It's just, I mean, and I'm not talking only about the Maltese context, I'm talking about
100%. My answer is yes, Adrian, but if you have obviously 20 subjects, the results will be very flawed. If you have 100 subjects, they'll be less flawed. If you have 200, they'll be even less flawed. So obviously that's the issue, and that's the reason why within the quantitative sphere, you must at least have, according to the number of variables you have, a certain amount of subjects. Now in this context, mathematically, 200 subjects was deemed to be enough to at least limit these sort of biases. So basically that's it. I mean, you see this, for example, nowadays in the election results. I mean, why is it that, for example, if you pick, you know, a few subjects from one district, you will know the electoral results here in Malta before actually unveiling all the votes. Because at a certain point in time, things equal out. This is like, you know, when you have, for example, a dice, for example, you know, if you actually throw a dice, for example, 10 times, no, you might get, for example, two even numbers and eight odd numbers. But if you throw it 20 times, slowly, you know, they will start matching each other. So it's just an issue of probability. Obviously, the higher amount of, the larger the sample, the less you're going to have also of these issues, such as bias, such as what is called the halo effect. What you are saying is the halo effect. So basically, you are presenting a questionnaire to somebody, and he's inclined, even from the way the questions are put, to answer in a certain way. They exist. Obviously, hopefully, the methodology is good enough to be able to do this.
I'd just like to follow up Adrian's first question on the possibility that the questionnaire itself might pit one language against another. I mean, I've been listening to your answers with respect to the nature of statistics and the justification given for the results. And clearly, the higher the number and the more random the number chosen, you're hoping to eliminate results which are do not reflect the population. However, there is a certain difference in the tables you did present, Sandro, I think. Mm-hmm. The first two tables, which we have here in front of us, allow for a wide variety of possibilities. That and whereas most of the other tables you gave us with the overhead projector were pitched in terms of the question favorable, unfavorable, favorable, neutral, unfavorable. So here we have a complex situation being presented as by your very statistics, by your own findings. We find that people are, if I follow these two tables adequately, people are fairly diverse in their use of English and Maltese. Mm-hmm. Yes, English and Maltese. English and Maltese. When I say diverse, I mean moving from father or mother or neighbor on the one hand to teacher on the other. There are different situations in which most subjects are using both languages. Again, in Table 2, we find again a great diversity. We find that when it comes to listening to the radio, reading the press, watching TV, or listening to music, with the possible exception of listening to music, we find that there's a diversity of responses, so that we can say your population of students subdivided fairly in a fairly balanced fashion between people who use Maltese and English in particular situations. So my point to you, or my question to you, is this. Your own statistics suggest that all members of the sample, or most members of the sample, use both languages in particular contexts. And their end result is that they're using both languages in various contexts. And I'm wondering if you can move easily from that to your tables with regard to three variables, favorable, neutral, or unfavorable. You see? That's the question I have for you, if you follow my question.
No, no problem. Now, first of all, attitudes obviously were described in terms of favorable, neutral, and unfavorable. However, keep in mind that in order to obtain that particular data, I didn't ask somebody, is your attitude towards Maltese favorable, neutral, unfavorable, and it was just a tick. It doesn't work that way. Basically, there are a series of questions, which are basically these. I'm not going to stay reading them out all. In which a student, a subject, placed within certain contexts, was asked whether basically he would use Maltese or English, whether he would strongly agree that within a context Maltese or English are important or Italian are important. So basically, the actual, well, what we call dependent variable, that is the attitude, favorable, neutral, and unfavorable, was actually the result of a series of questions that the subject was asked to answer. So what you are seeing here is the raw data, so to say, in which basically each and every response was classified according to the different contexts, as you said. Then, obviously, the various contexts were, so to say, summarized in order to have one particular variable regarding Maltese, the attitude towards Maltese, towards English, towards Italian, to be matched with the other so-called independent variables, which are age, gender, and all that. So, okay, here you've got what we can call the raw data. I could also have presented the raw data regarding attitudes themselves and how we actually came to the conclusion on attitudes themselves. But obviously, that is very complex, and it would also entail a lot of figures which are quite useless. So, again, as I said, I do believe that you can move from this context to the context of attitudes on the simple grounds that this is the raw score, whereas the attitudes is actually the final, so to say, score, which actually derives from a series of considerations. Then again, of course, in quantitative analysis, it is true that when you are actually simplifying things into one particular variable, you must also be careful on the way you are actually interpreting. Because when you are actually saying favorable attitude, also as I said at the beginning of the lecture, what does it actually mean? It means a series of things. So,
Does it make sense to ask you this question?
Yes.
Would it be possible to cross-correlate the raw scores they gave in these two tables, mm-hmm. where there's a variety of situations in which they talk to kin and to non-kin,
yes.
And to teachers,
yes.
and then situations in which they're listening to radio, press, TV, or music. Would it be possible to cross-correlate these results for any particular individual in your sample of 183, mm-hmm. with their favorability, unfavorability attitude. Because you've given us a lot of tables in which you have done is correlated their favorability to English or Maltese,
yes.
to age, to, excuse me, to gender, to mother tongue, to language of home community, class, and etc. But I'm wondering if it might be interesting to look at the diversity of each individual's use of the two languages and compare it with their overall favorability score.
Wait a sec, I didn't get this completely. So basically what you're asking is whether you could correlate the, not the attitudes you mean, the way each and every individual in the sample, basically the context in which they use Maltese or English. That's
I think it would be a multivariate analysis because you have 183. You have 183 students in the first year, and you have quite a few different categories of people they speak to, and types of listening they do.
That is I'm
aiming for actually an end result with a computer, whereby for all 183, you'd be able to relate their favorability to English and Maltese to the diversity of uses of those two languages.
I'm sure you could do that.
It might be interesting.
Definitely.
It might be interesting.
I mean, as you say, it's obviously...
Because it would be integrative. You say, when I say integrative, I mean you were bringing together actual use in a variety of contexts on the one hand with general favorability on the other.
You could, definitely, obviously, it would be possible to do that. I mean, I would say... Then again, obviously, you must also be a little bit careful regarding even the design, because, I mean, the design was clearly oriented, you know, to have, well, these variables on one end and the attitudes on the other. Now, if you're going to obviously try and, use the data, maybe to reach other ends, you must actually be careful that the data actually allows you to get that far, because obviously it also depends on the way you're actually coding results and all that. In theory, it would be possible. It's an interesting suggestion. I think I'll take it up. But if the computer, obviously, I have to check out a little bit whether the design actually and the way results have been coded actually allows you to get that far. Because as I said, it's mainly attitudes as dependent variables and other variables as independent. Okay.
Let me just ask one more question about the comparative study. This is part of a multinational study in which you're looking at different parts of Europe in which the three languages are involved. It seems that political factors must enter into this, and historical factors must enter into the comparisons you will be doing with your colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you'll move beyond statistics to some sort of discussion about the historical conflicts and political conflicts in the different zones. So it seems to me that you'll have to move out of analysis of linguistic correlations to a more general politico-historical account.
Wait,
and you'll have to involve, as it were, yourselves in dialogue with historians and
political science. Well, I mean, the whole, so to say, model is actually being reduced, so to say, to a table for each and every country, in which basically, well, statistically or not statistically, differences are basically going to be commented upon. And there's obviously the whole, each and every issue is obviously going to be seen within its political and historical context, certainly. Then as to, a general conclusion and a comparative, so to say, analysis, not only from a linguistic side, but also from a social, political, historical side. That is the intention, actually, of the whole project, too, definitely. But obviously, this will also be done at the second stage after all the results which have been, you know, put it together, and then you take it from there. But definitely, that is also the idea, also the introduction. The introduction obviously takes account of the situation and the various sociolinguistic situations in the various contexts and how these compare also to one another. I would say. So yes, that has to be done.
I think the audience would like to know when you hope to get together with the others and when we may see some publication.
Well, I mean, obviously these things take time. What I know for sure is that the publication has been approved by Multilingual Matters, that the design has already been basically structured. Now, obviously, as I said, the editors basically have to go through this. hopefully, if things move as they should, I believe that by the end of this year, hopefully by the end, by the beginning of next, there should actually be a publication in hand. And as I said, as I answered to Professor Brinkhaus' question, it is also envisaged that this would be only the start of maybe a more exhaustive, you know, and all comprehensive project, I would say. So I really can't answer your question myself, as I'm not really involved in, you know, I'm not the editor of the book, so basically, but definitely the publication has already been approved by a publishing house. By the end of this month, basically, is the deadline to give in all the chapters. Then it's basically a matter of editing, printing. I have been told that basically it should be, you know, well, within a year's time maximum, the whole study should be published, hopefully.
Right, well, I'm sure we all want to thank Sandrew very much for an extremely comprehensive and detailed report. And I must say, it's nice in a work-in-progress seminar series to be able to sit and listen to and discuss some very hard factual material. Thank you.